all profit is value extraction. And that means that all profit is theft from you.
Corporate America is on welfare, and we've got to get them off welfare.
Last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Welcome to Cars and Comrades, your favorite car communist podcast. Here with us today, we have me, Brandon, Zach, and Bryant, a bunch of he-hims. We are sadly short one Connor today due to technical difficulties. We're going to power through it. How's everybody doing today?
Pretty good.
Doing good.
Today, we are going to be discussing the history of hybrid cars. Bryant did some research for us and learned all about everything you need to know.
Yeah, it's more like I did a little bit of hyperfixation and went down a Wikipedia rabbit hole for a few days, and more on this later, but now I kind of want to buy a hybrid for a few reasons.
I've been actually looking into it. I can't do an EV. Wouldn't want to if I could. Don't really even want to buy something modern, but it might just work out that way for me.
Yeah. But I guess we'll do some project car updates. Anyone want to go first?
Mine might take a minute. Let's go. Okay. I have actually been working on my Chevy full tilt for the last 2 weeks. I have replaced the entire step portion underneath the driver's side door. I've replaced the entire rocker panel. I'm working on the wheel arch. It's been a combination of actual patch panels and me just making what I need. I got a little bit more to go, but actually, I have a lot more to go, but a little bit more before I think I'm actually going to try and put it back on the road. A lot of parts got real bad, and I went to one of my favorite junkyards. It's like an hour away, so I don't really go that often. But they actually had a third-gen Chevy van older than mine in the yard. So it was in decent shape in some portions. I stole the slider door and some stuff. Actually, I've started planning some upgrades for the Ford because I've had so many carburetor... I've spent my last 2 days, yesterday and this morning, working on my 73 Ford, which also, fun thing, was I went to go fucking renew my registration and realized that I've been wrong about what year my Ford is for 2 years. It is a 73, not a 74.
Oh.
Don't really know how I did that.
Real quick, I just want to acknowledge how awesome it is that you have a favorite junkyard.
Oh. is that not a thing?
I think, well, maybe amongst us, but not normal people, I'm going to say.
The guy really likes stuff from the 60s and 70s, so he won't scrap any of it. He told me once that when scrap prices were really high, he got rid of everything from the 90s. So there's just like this weird area in the yard buried sort of in the back that's like really overgrown. You really want to go in like early spring or late fall. God, dude, there's more Chevelles than you've ever fucking seen in your life. There's just fucking everything. Like the guy who's not the owner but is his like secondhand man. I was literally thinking about like... On the drive there, I was just thinking about how the overlap between, like, intense car guys and autism is probably a Venn diagram that is, yeah, like, a circle.
Yeah.
Then I got there, and, like, his right-hand man was working on an Oldsmobile. It was a 72 Cutlass. And when he found out that I had a Cutlass, he talked Oldsmobile at me for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, man. I was not planning for this, but I nailed it, because that dude knew just an autistic amount of stuff about Oldsmobiles.
Yeah, that's like the guy I got my, who cleaned my fuel injectors, last year, and talked at me about Saturns for, like, a good half hour.
Oh, Jesus. I did find out that apparently there is an Oldsmobile rear end that, if you have one, is worth around $20,000.
Holy shit.
Whoa.
Because it was sold in passenger cars, but it was considered an experimental rear end. So it was an aluminum housing with like steel like tubes pressed into it and like brazed. And I don't know. It's like it didn't sound like it was particularly great, but it's just super rare.
Yeah.
And somebody like came in and was talking to him about his car, and he's like, "Oh, remember that rear end you scrapped?" Like, I guess he had like sold one for like $300 to some random fucking guy to swap meet like 20 years earlier, and he was like, "Yeah, I just saw one sell for $23,000."
Damn.
Oh my god.
Like the listing wasn't even up for 2 days. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
I can't imagine being in a position where I would pay that much for an axle, but.
Yeah, no.
I mean, like, I can't, there's so many things I can't imagine. I can't imagine people paying like $40,000 for like some of these like classic cars. And not that that's even high end. It's just like, why do you have that much money that you can just put on a car?
Yeah.
Boomers. I don't know. Yeah, but okay. So this place is my favorite junkyard because there's probably a dozen or more like Chevy vans. But my Ford, which, you know. Reminder, that body style existed exclusively from 69 to 74, and they just didn't hold up very well. They have three of them in the junkyard, so I went to scour some parts to maybe do a V8 conversion, because I'm really fucking sick of the straight six and absolutely untunable carburetor that's on it. I get talking to them, I pull a bunch of other stuff, some to work on my friend's stuff, some sheet metal to work on my van, all this other shit, and I say, hey, how much would a 302 run me, and like how much for all of the brackets and everything, if like all three of their Ford second gen Fords are buried in the fucking woods, like you can barely open the doors because trees have grown up around them, they're just full of random bullshit. So rather than even dig through the one that was in the nicest shape, I ask them a few questions, and they're like, listen, if you're not sure what you need, that van has a low mileage motor. And then they like get real autistic about it and tell me the name of the dude who owned it, the year he bought it, the year that they scrapped it for him, and like all this shit. They like he didn't tell me the mile down to like the specific mile, but within 1,000 miles he told me the mileage of the motor. And it's like under 40,000 miles on this motor.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, okay, well, so how much? And he says, $300. And I'm like, holy fuck, with all the brackets and everything? And he's like, listen, I don't know what you need, and nobody has ever given a shit about that van, so just bring a trailer, and we're going to cut the front half of the van off for you from the engine forward, and you're just going to take it all, and then you definitely have anything you need. And I'm like,
okay,
you're selling me half of a van for $300. That's ridiculous, both that you're doing that and that I'm excited to buy half a van. But I will take it.
Yeah.
Because I finally like got to dig around in one of the V8 vans. And yeah, it's just different than mine. I need a different doghouse, different brackets. I doubt that the oil pan is anything too special, but like a regular 302 car oil pan won't fit on it. Shit like that. So I'm not rushing to go buy that because I'm not trying to start any more projects and I'm already like knuckle deep in, but I grabbed some stuff for my Chevy, have gotten back to work on that. I am now, I got to put in one more patch before I'm going to start doing the Bondo and sanding, and then I got to buy a bunch of shit to paint, which I'm both looking forward to doing and dreading spending all of the money that I'm about to spend on shit to paint, because I can't imagine I'm going to spend less than $1,000. Because I got to fix my air compressor, buy guns, buy paint, learn what the fuck I'm doing, all that shit. But it'll still be cool. I'm excited. And that's taken a lot of time. Because fitting patch panels is a fucking headache. Cutlass. Oh, got new tires on the Cutlass. Found a nice set of what is apparently the biggest size tire that will fit in the Cutlass without any modification or rubbing. Which I got real lucky because I was ballparking it. So I went and just found some random fucking Facebook marketplace ad that, like, I don't even have Facebook, but they had the name of the shop that they were located at listed in the ad. And I'm like, I can just show up and buy these. Fuck yeah. So I went and got new tires. It was $100 for the rear pair, $120 it was, with good tread. So That was sick. So, yes, I have been working my ass. This isn't even including work I've been doing for other people on their cars, because a couple of people in the neighborhood and a couple of friends have needed help with stuff. So, I've been very busy, but that I think that sums it up pretty well, because I am mildly pressed for time today because I have to do more to the Ford. I took almost the entire dash on the Ford apart to eliminate rattles and like all this shit. I swapped out my seats. I flip-flopped the driver and passenger side because the driver's side is broken, and I did not realize how uncomfortable it was until I finally swapped them out earlier today. It's fucking miserable. Like, I think my back is going to thank me after this next 350-mile drive.
Yeah,
dude, I think I said I spent the whole fucking morning getting my carburetor torn apart and put back together. Finally got that fixed and running. So it's been a very productive few weeks on my end. My bank account hates it, but all my cars are doing great. Cool. And yeah, that's me. Who wants to go next? Brian, what have you been up to this past week? Or two, sure. Or three. Whenever the last time we fucking recorded.
Yeah, it's been a while. Not a whole lot. Basically, the only thing I've done is swap the summer tires onto my Subaru. And it does drive a lot nicer now that it's not got, you know, 3 feet of sidewall and kind of knobby treads. And so been enjoying driving that. It you know, the what do you call it? Less inertia of the, you know, lighter weight wheels and tires has less inertia, so you notice it accelerates a little bit easier. Or maybe that's just me. And more on this later, but I was looking at different, you know, hybrid cars for sale that I might get. And, you know, the 0-60 time and the power to weight ratio and that kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of them, like, on paper, my Subaru has good power, you know, good acceleration, but I've got the Cobb access port thing, and one of the things it'll do is track your 0-60 time, and I'd never done that before. So last night I was like, you know, oh, I'll give this a shot just on a, you know, empty back road or whatever, and I only got like I think it's rated from the factory at like 6.3 seconds 0-60. And I got about 7.5 seconds. So I don't know if that just means it's an old tired car, or if it's I'm bad at doing drag launches, or I just have too much mechanical sympathy to rev up the engine and, you know, dump the clutch. But yeah, I guess maybe my my drag racing career is, you know, not going the greatest in that. But yeah, I think that's about all I've been up to. Oh, and I went for a bike ride after, you know, it being cold for a while, and I'd been, you know, doing my trainer indoors, you know, like a stationary bike, and now I'm like, hey, I'm still in shape. You know, I'm not, like, wheezing up the hills. Like, I can go fast on my bike. This is fucking awesome. So it actually worked. And I think I might have told you guys, but I'm thinking of taking a trip to Cuba in the fall, and yep. One of the things that I can do is a like a bicycle tour of a couple cities, like going maybe 30-40 miles in between a couple cities. So I'm thinking of doing that now.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds super fun.
Yeah. So we'll see. I haven't, you know, booked that or even looked into it too much. I've got a bunch of other stuff going on right now, but still really done nothing on the MR2 except take it in and out of my garage when I have to work on my Subaru. Oh, and I think since we last talked, I did like the pressure test where you pump up the intake and check for leaks. And I think I fixed all those, had to put some RTV on some things, and it runs better now. It's still not 100%. So I think I need to contact that tuner and get an actual tune for it, but I might sell it anyways, so I don't know if I really want to fuck with it anymore, although I need to get it to pass emissions in the next month, so I'm gonna have to do something with it or just sell it in the next month. Let it be someone else's problem.
There you go.
So
Wait, has anyone on the show sold anything since we started the show?
I did.
Yeah?
I sold the Audi.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yep.
For all of the dumb projects we have, I can't believe that there's been one sell. We've been doing this show, like, what, 3 years almost?
Yeah.
Yeah. I sold a bunch of random crap that I had in my crawl space, like a, like an old
I mean, I've gotten rid of parts. Not many, but some.
Yeah.
The closest I've come was, like, some of the scrap vans that I owned went to scrap.
Hmm.
It's not really the same.
Yeah. All right. But, yeah, that's about it. I'm sure I'll think of something in a minute here. But, Zach, what have you been working on?
Not too much, really. Just been enjoying driving my pickup, my 97 250. It's been going pretty good. No major issues other than it's a diesel, so it's got a plug in the front of it to plug in the block heater. And I pulled on the extension cord and pulled the plug right off the wire.
Oh.
So now I get to fix that because I was an idiot and didn't grab the plug and the extension cord. I just yanked on the extension cord. And yeah, that plug just came right off. So I'll have to fix that sometime soon. But it's warm out now, so it's been starting up just fine in the morning without the block heater. So that's on the list. But no, I really haven't been up to much else. Trying to sell parts off the Subaru parts car still. I actually had a guy that was supposed to come out on Saturday to look at the parts car because he was going to buy the whole thing. And I was like, hey man, you know, if you want to take the whole thing off my hands, I'll give you everything I have left for it for $500. Like, I just don't want it to be my problem anymore. And I need to get rid of it. And he was like, okay, yeah, sure. I'll come check it out. It's on a trailer, right? And I was like, no, it's not on a fucking trailer. What makes you think it's on a trailer? And then he just stopped responding.
No.
So, I guess he wanted it to be trailered to his place. And I was like, I mean, if it was on a trailer, we could talk about it. But I don't know why you're assuming it's on a trailer. Like, yeah. I never mentioned anything about that. So, yeah, I don't know. That guy is wanting something for nothing, I think. And so I didn't really... didn't really think it was going to go anywhere after he asked if it was on the trailer and he stopped responding. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll hang on to it for a little while longer now, see if I can sell a few more parts off of it. And then I am planning on moving here in the next month or two, so I have to have it sold by then. So if you want a Subaru STI shell, hit me up. If this is out before I get rid of it, I will give you a very good deal on it if you... say you're a listener to Cars and Comrades, shit, man, I might just give it to you. Because I don't want to deal with it anymore.
And you've already made back your money on it, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely have made back my money and then some. So yeah. I'm also probably going to sell the long block out of it now because I have another car, so I'm probably just going to build the motor that's in my WRX currently because it can be down for a while. I don't have to drive it like daily. So if you're looking for an STI long block, I've got one of those. And again, if you're a listener, I will hook you up on that shit.
Yeah. And if you're a listener and want to buy a Subaru, let me know.
Yeah.
I'm not selling anything. Fuck off. Not my MO.
Well, yeah, that's about it for me. I haven't really been doing too much. Just enjoying having a running, driving vehicle.
Yeah, that's really nice. That's one reason why I'm like, maybe I should get a hybrid rather than messing around with all these vacuum lines and bullshit.
Yeah.
It's kind of why I haven't... I'm ready to swap the transmission and the Cutlass, like, whenever. But it runs and drives right now, and it's just so hard to take it off the road, even if it's just for a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you never know what's going to happen. You go to swap it, and then some other issue will come up because you've... messed with shit and the voodoo has been messed with and it doesn't work anymore because car magic. You know, you unscrew one bolt and all of a sudden the car's mad.
I swear to God, like, my best friend does not understand that concept. And he is a car guy, like, through and through. He's got a bunch of really cool stuff. But he's constantly saying, like, just fix this one thing really quick. And I'm like, you know how that works.
Yeah.
One time I was, it's actually my buddy I'm driving out to visit this week. And one time right before I left, dude, it was 9 o'clock in the morning and I'm loading stuff up in the van to drive home. And he's like, "Hey, I just noticed this. Let's fix it real quick." And I'm like, "Don't fucking touch it." And he just starts taking stuff apart. And it took me 3 hours to leave because the thing that should only take a second to fix was obviously rusted to fucking shit. And like, just, we took everything apart. And then he was like, "Oh, this is a lot different than I was expecting it to be." And we couldn't find any parts for it and just had to put it back together as it was. And I'm like, it's okay to listen to me when it's my own vehicles, dude.
Yeah.
I did that to myself one time. I was late for work because I was like, "Oh, I can just fix the fuel system on my car real quick before work." And that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I actually did help a friend out not too long ago with her car. Because it wasn't coming up to temperature. So I was like, "Oh, it's a bad thermostat. Your thermostat's stuck open. Easy peasy." I tore it all apart. And then I was like, "Okay, let's go get the thermostat. I'm sure somewhere we'll have it in stock." And nowhere in the city did. So I was like, "Okay, well, I'm going to put it all back together. Sorry. Come back when the thermostat comes in and we'll fix it then."
Was it at least something where the thermostat's moderately easy to do?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. It was tucked away pretty tight. It was on a Kia, so it was not a ton of space to work, but, you know, I got it done in like an hour. It wasn't too bad.
I had to do the brake lines on one of my neighbor's car just to help them out, and one of the lines had rusted through so badly that it finally just blew out. And it was a 2011, and, you know, it's lived in Pennsylvania long enough that the brake line had rusted through and blew. And I was still absolutely blown away by how easy everything was to get apart because it was only 2011. Mm-hmm. I'm like, "Oh, shit, dude, I'm used to working on everything from the 60s and 70s. This is the Cadillac of turning wrenches right here." Like,
yeah. 10 years of rust is a lot different than 50 or 60 years of rust.
It really fucking is.
Yeah.
I still don't know how the brake line even rusted through, though, because I'm pretty sure I got 50-year-old brake lines on some of my shit, and it's running along fine.
Don't make them like they used
to. Don't make them like they used to. Oh, my
God. Yeah, now they can actually survive a crash.
Yeah.
Oh, one of the rabbit holes I was going down was looking at K cars, and like, you can get a K car pretty cheap, like $5,000, you know, shipped to the US with all the fees and everything, but they're just so unsafe. Like, there's like no crumple zones. It's so tiny. So, yeah,
you're just,
I mean,
describing to me the kind of stuff I normally drive.
Yeah.
I've actually seen a few of those driving around town lately. One of them is even slightly customized.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I know someone that has Subaru Sambar microvan. Pretty cool little machine.
Fuck yeah, those are rad as hell.
Yeah. He like takes it camping and stuff. Well, should we take a break, or should we go right into talking about hybrids, or do we have anything else going on?
Well, I don't think we've ever gotten car updates done in less than 30 minutes, so I don't really see the need to take a break.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm good to go.
So, I'm going to start off talking a little bit, and for the listener, this is going to get real nerdy, so just buckle up, I guess. I'm going to talk a little bit about the different types of hybrids, and then I'll go into sort of the history of hybrids, and then some of the more modern ones, and if we have time today, which we probably don't, this might be a two-parter, I'm going to talk a lot about the Chevy Volt. Which is what I'm thinking about driving or buying myself, and sort of like what makes it interesting and special and why I think everyone should be driving one. Maybe not everyone, but lots of people. So there's three major types of hybrid vehicles, and some vehicles sort of overlap into different categories. So like it might be one type in one scenario, and then in, you know, a different driving mode or whatever. It might act as a different type. So the first is parallel hybrid, and this is how most hybrids work today. They have an electric motor and a gas motor, and they use them together to power the vehicle. So at the same time, usually. Sometimes you'll have like a Prius or whatever will start on electric and then kick in the gas motor later. And sometimes like the Honda Insight, the first generation, it'll have the gas motor running all the time and use the electric motor as sort of a boost to give it a little bit more power. And a lot of hybrid cars today are a mild hybrid, and that basically just means you have a smaller electric motor that is not only used to like start and stop the engine, so like the engine will stop at a stoplight and it'll start up again really quickly when you need to move. So basically you just have an electric motor that's, you know, like on the flywheel that is like usually your alternator and your starter motor, and gives you a little bit of a boost in certain situations. And then the other type of hybrid is a series hybrid. And that is when you have an electric motor that drives the wheels all the time, and a gas motor that runs a generator to power the batteries, basically. And there's a few vehicles made today that are like that. The BMW i3 with a range extender. So there's a BMW i3 that's just a pure electric vehicle, and then there's one with a smaller battery and a little gas motor that runs sometimes to get you more range. And then what I'll be talking about later, the Chevy Volt, fits into this category some of the time, although it can act as a parallel hybrid some of the time. So more, we'll get into more of that later. And then there's also plug-in hybrid vehicles, which is basically just any hybrid that you can plug into a wall and charge up the battery rather than using relying on the gas motor to charge the battery. So this is becoming more common. You know, usually they have a little bit bigger battery, so they can take advantage of that. And sometimes you can drive on all electric mode for several miles before the gas motor needs to kick in. So, I don't know. Does that kind of make sense to everyone?
Yeah, so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that a lot of that was formal distinctions, but I knew that some used electric motors to actually drive it. Well, a gas and the electric motor to drive it, and that some effectively used a gas generator to power the electric.
Yeah. Okay, so the first hybrid car was actually built by Ferdinand Porsche, you know, the guy that started the Porsche sports car company. This was around 1900. So in 1897, he started working at the Bela Egger and Company electrical company in Vienna. And this is where he designed the first electric hub motor. So we've talked a little bit, like, with the Lordstown Motors. They were hyping their in-wheel hub motors.
Yeah, I still don't understand how that's a good idea, but...
Yeah, I mean, so in 1897, it was sort of a way to add electric motors to, like, a carriage and turn it into a car, basically.
It does seem more practical in that sense.
Yeah. And let's see. And so Porsche moved on to the Jacob Lohner Company, also in Vienna. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Lohner. And this is when they actually started putting this into production. So at this time period, like, electric cars were pretty popular because gasoline cars, you had to start them with a crank, and you could, you know, break your arm if you did that wrong, if it backfired on you. And then there was also steam-powered cars, but that would need, like, half an hour to get it hot enough, basically, to drive away. So electric cars were popular, especially for women who didn't want to deal with all the crank starting and fire and all that stuff. So they were advertised towards women, at least. I don't. Maybe we'll do another episode on just electric cars, and we can talk about this some more. But like, there used to be like charging infrastructure and like all the stuff for electric cars before the electric starter motor was invented and made gas cars more popular. Basically, kind of a what could have been thing. If Charles Kettering was never around.
I'm past the point where I long to see what the U.S. would have looked like if we had electric cars from the get-go, and I'm just like, we just should not have invested in car infrastructure.
Yeah, that is the big problem. Like, highways suck no matter what kind of cars on them.
Yeah.
So, Lohner and Porsche started making these electric cars, but they had these big, heavy lead acid batteries at the time, which was really the state of the art up until like the 90s. And so they're like, well, how can we make this lighter and have actually decent range? So they just put two gasoline motors and two generators on this car and made the first hybrid. So the word hybrid wasn't really invented at the time, or at least for cars.
What are you drawing?
A Liger.
What's a Liger?
It's pretty much my favorite animal. It's like a lion and a tiger mixed. Bred for its skills and magic.
So they used the Latin word semper vivus, which means forever alive. Basically, the battery's not going to go dead because you can just fill it up with gasoline and keep going. So this was still a 2,600-pound car. Back when, you know, like, Model Ts were, like, what, 1,000 pounds or something? You know, this was
I definitely think they were more than that, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, this was a heavy car for the time period, you know. They built a few different varieties of this, including one with four hub motors, so it had four-wheel drive. They also started calling them the Mixte, I think is how you pronounce it, M-I-X-T-E. Which is the French word for mixed. So it's mixed electric and gas. And this actually remained in production until 1915. But they cost the equivalent of $80,000 to $200,000 in today's money. Oh, so God. They didn't sell a whole lot of them. They did get the interest of the Emperor of Austro-Hungary. The Austro-Hungarian Empire. So the military used trucks with this technology to haul artillery during World War I because they had four-wheel drive, basically. That was like, I don't think, you know, mechanical four-wheel drive systems had really been perfected by World War I, but I don't know.
Yeah, I really don't know the history of four-wheel drive.
Yeah. So, a little bit about Ferdinand Porsche. He went on to design tanks and other military vehicles for the Nazi Wehrmacht during the Second World War. He was also a member of the Nazi Party and an officer in the SS. And his factories used a lot of slave labor, mostly Soviet POWs that would be worked to death. So, not a cool guy, if you ask me.
I don't think we're going to argue that point.
Yeah.
This is a little bit similar to Felix Wankel. In 1945, after the war, a lot of the Porsche and Volkswagen factory equipment was moved into France as reparations. And they also were like, hey, Mr. Porsche, why don't you come along and work in this factory too? We'd really like you to do that, and we won't kill you if you do that. And so he did that for a while. He was asked to help work on the Renault 4 CV. And then it says, which led to serious conflict with the recently appointed head of Renault, the former resistance hero, Pierre Lefaucheux. So basically this Antifa super soldier guy was like, had to work with this fucking Nazi Wehrmacht SS dipshit. And they got in arguments, as you could imagine.
They could have given them the Boeing whistleblower treatment. And...
yeah. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Basically, there was some bureaucratic mess that caused the factory to shut down. And let's see. Also, at one point, he was imprisoned as a war criminal. Basically, his family had to, like, ransom him out of French jail. They're like, yeah, if you give us enough money, we'll let this war criminal go. It's fine.
God, I hate that. I hate that so much.
Yeah. So going back to 1917, General Electric designed a prototype of the first diesel electric locomotive.
Now, so, what country are we in? Like, what country's army was he a general in?
This is in the United States.
Badumptus.
Yeah. So this is still used on the majority of locomotives today. Most are diesel electric. And this is when you have a big diesel engine that turns a generator, and then that electrically powers motors at each of the drive wheels, or drive axles, I should say. And that is an advantage over, like, steam trains, for one, because it's much more efficient. A diesel engine is a lot more efficient than a steam engine, just thermodynamically. But then also... you know, instead of having those big, long crossbars that link all the drive wheels together on a steam train, you can just have electric motors at each axle, and you get much better traction that way without all the reciprocating mass and weird linkages and shit like that. Now, the reason that they were first adopted in the U.S. is because train yards, like where they were switching, you know... trains moving cargo between different lines and whatnot, they had what they call switchers or switching engines, which is basically just like a little tug steam train, a locomotive that you would use to move trains or train cars around the yard and link them together and stuff. And those put out a lot of pollution and smoke from the, you know, burning coal. And since train yards tended to be in the middle of cities, people are like, oh, I don't like all this smoke and ash falling on my house.
NIMBY bullshit.
Yeah. So in 1925, the U.S. government is like, you're not allowed to use steam engines for switching inside of cities. So that's when they started moving to mostly diesel electric. And then, you know, eventually they got on as the main locomotive for moving stuff. Like, I think in the 50s, I think, is when that shift started happening. All right. And so there's not a whole lot that happened with hybrid technology in the 20th century, but I'll, you know, touch on a few here. So in 1980, the Briggs & Stratton corporation that makes lawnmower engines, they built a prototype hybrid car sort of in response to the 1970s oil crisis. They used a 18 horsepower boxer twin and a 8 horsepower electric motor with a one-way clutch connecting them, so that basically if the gasoline engine was running, it would drive that clutch and all of them together, but you could also just use the electric motor. And then that just went into a 4-speed manual transmission and a regular rear end. But they had such a big lead acid battery pack in the back that to hold the weight, they added a third axle. So it has 6 wheels, but only 2 of them were driven. Here, I can send you the link here if you want to see some pictures of it.
I mean, a third axle is always a good look.
Uh huh.
I enjoy.
Yeah, it's pretty funky looking. I think they used like a bunch of like Volkswagen and Datsun body pieces to like make this car. It's a little strange, and it had an 18 horsepower gas motor, an 8-horsepower electric motor.
Yes, I genuinely like the look of this car.
Yeah, I thought you might like it. Let's see. So
interesting that they used a boxer.
Yeah.
Is there any particular reason for that?
I think that was the biggest engine that Briggs & Stratton made at the time.
Okay.
Before they had like their V-twins overhead valve engines. I think this is a flathead engine also.
Gotcha.
Why? I mean, okay, Briggs & Stratton, but...
Yeah. Let's see. So it could go for up to 45 miles on electricity alone. Top speed was 68 miles an hour. And I couldn't find too much information on this, but it said that it only got 30 miles per gallon. I think that's when it's on gas only. But you'd think a hybrid with only, 26 horsepower would have better mileage than that, but...
That is hauling a lot of weight, though, if they had to add an extra fucking axle just for that.
Yeah.
And when you factor in that, 10 or 15 years ago, hybrids were still making, 40.
Right.
I mean, I think a little bit over that, but still, for this being the 80s and new technology, 30 seems feasible.
Yeah. So the first mass-produced hybrid electric car was actually the Toyota Prius, which came to market in Japan, a little bit before the U.S. in 1997. And just because I'm a nerd and also whoever wrote this Wikipedia article is also a nerd about grammar. So some people will say Prii as the plural of Prius, but that's grammatically incorrect in Latin. The correct is Priora.
Oh, I call them Priapod.
I mean, honestly, you can call them whatever you want. I don't really care. Prius is fine. But if you want to be real pedantic, you can say, actually, it's Priora. So the word Prius, I mean, it basically means like something that comes before, or it's an adjective for something that comes before. So the idea is that it would be like the first hybrid car that would sort of inspire all these other hybrid cars in the future, which it kind of did.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah. But Toyota doesn't have the copyright for Priora because the Russian car company Lada copyrighted that in 2007. So
they don't have the copyright for it because Lada came up with it 10 years later?
Yeah, that's all I saw on Wikipedia, so I don't know if what came first and what legally happened with that, but...
Fair enough.
It's
also not wildly out of the realm of possibility that a company would just overlook a certain step, because shit like that happens.
Like, there is some American guy whose last name is Nissan, who owned Nissan.com for a long time. So, just a little bit about the technology of the Prius, because I think it's kind of interesting, even though they are kind of boring cars. The development project began in 1994, headed by Takahisa Yagishi, I believe is how you say that. So, it has an Atkinson cycle engine, which is... So, this guy Atkinson was a British engineer, around 100 years ago. And he created this bizarre linkage system where the power stroke was longer than the compression stroke. And that's to get more efficiency out of the engine, basically. So you compress it, the intake and compression stroke are short, and then the power stroke is long, so you get more energy out of the expanding gases.
I think I have seen diagrams of those.
Yeah. They look kind of like a steam engine with a bunch of weird linkages on the crankshaft. The way that that's done in the modern day is they just have a cam profile that basically keeps the intake valves open for part of the compression stroke so that it, pulls in a fresh charge of air and then pushes out some of that during the compression stroke so that you have a smaller volume of air in the combustion chamber, and then you expand it more than you would with a regular auto cycle. So you get better efficiency, but then you get less power, basically. And a little side tangent, the Mazda Millennia, sort of like a luxury car in the, what is it, late 90s, had a V6 with, it was an Atkinson cycle with a supercharger, which they called a Miller cycle. So basically, it keeps the those intake valves open longer because the supercharger is pushing air past the valves during the compression stroke. And so basically you can get better efficiency and better power out of those. They're pretty interesting engines. I'm not sure why that it was only Mazda using that technology, but yeah. So it has the Atkinson cycle engine, a planetary gear, continuously variable transmission, which I'll get into that in a second, a permanent magnet AC motor, and nickel metal hydride battery pack. So this is like the same chemistry that's used in like rechargeable batteries, like AA batteries that you buy at the store to power your remote or whatever. And it was only 1.78 kilowatt hours, the battery pack, which is about like five times smaller than I think the Prius battery pack is today. It was a little bitty thing. And they decided to try and keep the battery, like the life of the battery pack increased by using only a certain percentage of the capacity. So they designed all the software and everything to keep the battery no lower than 40% charged and no more than 60% charged. And then the idea is that it would just last longer. So they had to design a motor controller that used, you know, like big heavy duty transistors to like switch the DC from the battery into AC power for the motor. And they borrowed technology for the Shinkansen bullet train for this. The gas motor makes 70 horsepower on the first generation Prius, and the electric motor is 44 horsepower and 258 foot-pounds of torque, just from the motor, that is. And an updated version arrived in the U.S. in 2001. That was the first Prius that we got here. It was rated at 52 miles per gallon city, 45 highway, and 48 combined. And so I'll try and explain how a planetary gear set works for a continuously variable transmission, but I'll also put in the show notes some videos that explain this in more depth.
Interested to see how you're going to try and explain this, but yeah, if you're curious how planetary gear sets work, just fucking Google it.
Yeah, you really need like a visual aid to understand this. It's pretty weird. So, you know, planetary gears have been around for a while, like they've been used in bicycles and automatic transmissions and all kinds of stuff. And the reason they're called a planetary gear set is they have three things, one inside the other. So in the middle is what they call the sun gear, and it's just a regular gear. And then around that, you usually have maybe three or more planet gears that are meshed with the sun gear. And they're connected, their axles, I should say, are connected to each other with what's called the planetary carrier. And then on the outside is a ring gear, which is like a gear that's inside out with the teeth facing inwards. And so all of these mesh together and you have them rotating on their own bearings. And in an automatic transmission, the way that it works is using brakes to usually stop the, I think it's the ring gear, or let it go. And that changes your gear ratio. Is that sound right? I don't know. Do you guys know about how automatic transmissions work?
No matter how much I read about automatic transmissions, they don't make any more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot put it together in my mind.
It's a hydraulic computer, and that's all you need to know, because that's the most that it can ever possibly make sense to your average person.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, just if you don't want to go through a lot of diagrams and videos and stuff, just it's magic, and just leave it at that.
Yep.
So you can use a planetary gear as a transmission like that, you know, like two-speed transmission. Most automatic transmissions, they stack up several of these to make, you know, a four or a six-speed transmission or whatever. The you can also use them as a differential. So I believe Subaru's, their center differential is a planetary gear set.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so what that does is you can either have two inputs and one output, or one input and two outputs. So I believe on the Subaru, you can either have like a power source connected to like the ring gear, the planetary gear, the planet carrier, or you can have one of those be the output. So it can act as, so basically as you speed up one motor, it changes the gear ratio for the other motor. So that's how it becomes a continuously variable transmission in the Prius, is you have the main electric motor is attached to the ring gear of this planetary gear set. The second smaller electric motor is attached to the sun gear, and the engine is connected to the planetary carrier. So you can, by varying the speed of the, the main electric motor is connected with a gear to the wheels through a differential. So basically whenever the vehicle is moving, the main electric motor is moving. And so that can be used to, you know, drive the car or do regenerative braking. And then the gasoline engine can be either stationary or running. And most gas engines have an RPM, a speed that they're most efficient at. So this transmission is trying to keep the engine at that most efficient speed. And it uses the second smaller electric motor connected to the sun gear to either speed up, slow down, or reverse to change that gear ratio to keep the engine running at its optimal speed for whatever driving conditions you're doing and how much power you need. And then it can also, depending on how you do things, act as a generator to top off the battery with the smaller electric motor and the planetary gear set running at a certain speed. So that's a little bit complicated. Just look at some diagrams, watch the videos, and I promise it'll make some sense. But I just thought that's a really clever idea, and I don't know why it doesn't get used more. I don't know why there's like not... Every automatic car should be a hybrid as far as I'm concerned. But I'm sure there's reasons why that's not the case.
Dude, even a lot of like super or hyper cars or whatever now are starting to do hybrid stuff because there's just a lot of potential for it.
I think also like a lot of rich people got tired of the London congestion charge for gasoline-powered vehicles, and I think it's Paris is doing something similar where they basically charge you like $20 to drive into the city if you don't have an electric car.
Never heard of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's all like only in the city center. I think New York was floating a similar idea at some point. So back to history of hybrids. The first hybrid actually sold in the U.S. was the Honda Insight in 1999. So this is a compact, very lightweight, two-door hatchback with an aluminum body. So it weighs only 1,847 pounds. and has a drag coefficient of 0.25. So at the time, this was the most aerodynamic production car ever built. And because it's so light, a lot of people buy them and put K-series engines in them and drag race them. So, yeah, people will, like, swap all-wheel drive systems into these from, like, a CRV. And there's some pretty awesome performance cars built out of these just because they're so light. It's also just very efficient. So it has a 67-horsepower, 1-liter, 3-cylinder engine. And this has a version of the Honda Lean Burn technology, where the air-to-fuel ratio can reach up to 25.8 to 1 during...
Wow.
Yeah, that is lean.
So that is one of the keys to its efficiency. It also has an electric motor that is sort of built into the flywheel area of the engine that adds another 13 horsepower and 36 pounds of torque. So your total is 73 horsepower and 91 foot-pounds of torque. And the electric motor also acts as a generator during deceleration and braking to recharge the battery. So, and it also acts as the starter motor. So this is like the first of the sort of the mild hybrids that I was talking about. And it's also one of the only hybrid cars to have a manual transmission. You could get it with a CVT automatic. It wasn't the same planetary style CVT as the Prius. It's like a sort of, you know, pulley and belt style CVT, I believe. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people like that because they're like, oh, I want an efficient car, but I want a manual. So they get one of these.
I mean, never forget that for a long time, manuals were more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was the most fuel efficient car sold in the US for a long time, basically up until 2015. And it was rated at 70 miles per gallon highway, 61 city, which still better than most hybrid cars you can buy today, unless it's a plug-in, which we'll get into the sort of controversy on that. So that was the first generation Insight. They did later do, I think, second and third generation, but those were more conventional sedans, and they had a more conventional planetary gear set transmission like in a Prius. So if we have time right now, I'm going to go into the Chevy Volt and why I think they're cool. So first, I want to make the distinction. We're talking about the Volt with a V and not the Chevy Bolt with a B, which is a pure electric hatchback that I believe they still sell. The Volt, first one on sale in 2011. It was also sold as a Holden in Australia, a Buick in China, a Vauxhall in the UK, and an Opel in Europe.
Jesus.
and they were all built in the Detroit Hamtramck assembly plant, which I think is just fun to say Hamtramck.
I've been there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think I have, too. Not to that plant, but I've been to Detroit and Hamtramck. It's just, you know, like one of the suburbs of Detroit, I think.
Nope, it's in Detroit.
Oh, okay,
really? It's very unusual for being fully surrounded by Detroit.
Okay.
Like, on all sides.
So it's like Lakeside or whatever in Denver.
Yeah, but like, is that like a neighborhood or is it actually like its own city?
It's its own city.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, fun little story. So Lakeside started as an amusement park in Denver, like with roller coasters and stuff. And they decided to like incorporate and get their own zip code and stuff so that people could send postcards from there that said it's from, you know, Lakeside, Colorado rather than Denver, I guess. But now it's just like this little, like, what, 4-block city that has a strip mall and an amusement park and a few houses.
Oh. No, Hamtramck is actually like a place. Not to get too much into the weeds of the history of Hamtramck, it might not exist anymore because it has having like budgetary issues and was getting folded into the city of Detroit. But for a long time, it was like one of the only cities in America that was fully inside of a separate city.
Okay. Well, so the Volt, depending on who you ask, is either a series hybrid like the Porsche Loaner, or an electric vehicle with the range extender like the BMW i3. I'm going to call it a plug-in hybrid because that's how it acts most of the time. It's a hybrid that you can plug in and charge the battery. It does have a larger battery than most hybrid cars, but it's also smaller than most pure electric vehicle batteries. So during most driving conditions, the Volt relies solely on its 149 horsepower main electric motor. It has a 16 kilowatt hour lithium manganese oxide battery, which I don't know the chemistry behind that, but it's supposed to be longer lasting than most other types of lithium batteries. The battery weighs around 500 pounds and it's shaped like a capital letter T. It's located underneath the center console of the car and the rear seat. The battery will last you about 35 miles of pure EV driving, at which time the 80 horsepower 1.4 liter gasoline combustion engine starts up and powers a 74 horsepower motor generator. So the thing with AC motors, or any electric motor for that matter, is that you can use them as a generator or a motor, basically just by switching where the electricity goes. So this is when it's acting like a series hybrid, like the Porsche Loaner, and the engine is just charging up the batteries and producing electricity to go through the motor controller to power the motor. So at some speeds above 30 miles an hour, the combustion engine can power the wheels directly. So the battery can be fully charged from a 120 volt wall outlet in about 10 hours or 4 hours for a 240 volt plug. And I don't know, real quick, you might hear about like electric vehicles charging being like level 4 or 5. This is level 1 or 2. Level 1 is a 110 volt. Level 2 is 240 volt. So this is not a lot of power going into the battery at any given time.
Wait, so how many amps is like a level 4 or 5?
I don't know. I think it's like, I think the Volt one is like 3 kilowatt hours, and those are like 100 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
A lot of batteries are measured in a unit called kilowatt hours. So a kilowatt is power. It's 750 watts to 1 horsepower. And it's basically saying, you know, it can put out this much power for 1 hour and until it's depleted or whatever. But the way, like, if you're a real physics nerd, that, like, notation might bother you and you might want to use joules as a measure of energy, which would make more sense and have fewer letters in the acronym. But for whatever reason, the industry standard is kilowatt hours, and that's what I'll use on this. Also worth noting, like, I think the average e-bike battery is like a few hundred kilowatt hours, or excuse me, a few hundred watt hours, I should say. So like 400 to 700 watt hours. Most electric cars are around like 80 kilowatt hours, so like 80,000 watt hours. So like, I think I've said this before, but you know, the average electric car battery pack, you could make several hundred e-bike batteries out of that same battery pack. And a Volt battery pack could make a few dozen e-bike batteries, depending on how you slice it up. Let's see. So the way that the drivetrain works on a Volt is different than a Prius. The combustion motor and the two motor generators are connected in series by clutches, so that basically you can decouple the motor, you can decouple the combustion engine and use only the single motor to drive the wheels, the two motors, or all three together. And it really only uses all three at speeds above 30 miles an hour because the engine is not going to be in its, it's not going to be in its optimum RPM range, except when you're moving somewhat quick.
Yeah.
Because you basically have a one speed transmission and there's only so many, you know, speeds that that works at. Actually, I lied. It's actually a two speed transmission because in between the two electric motors is a two speed planetary gear set that acts like a two speed automatic transmission. They kind of overbuilt this thing. It was sort of their production prototype. So all the combustion engine and the two electric motors combined would make 303 horsepower.
Respectable.
Yeah. But it never gets that much power to the wheels at any given time. You're limited to 149 horsepower.
Hmm. Well, that's like...
And 273 pound-feet of torque. So, like, it does have decent torque off the line, I will say. So the curb weight is around 3,800 pounds, depending on the options. So it has about the same power-to-weight ratio as a Suzuki Cappuccino K-car. 0 to 60 acceleration takes 8.8 seconds, about the same as a 1962 Corvette Stingray. So I think that shows how far Corvettes have come more than anything. So you can drive on electric only for about 38 miles before the gas engine kicks in. And then if you're just running on gas only, you'll get about 37 miles per gallon. And that's kind of where the controversy lies between the General Motors marketing department, the EPA, the different government agencies trying to figure out what qualifies as miles per gallon on this thing. Because Chevrolet was like, well, obviously we're going to do the test with a fully charged battery, you know, and then it gets 100 miles per gallon. And they're like, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, I was wondering like what the metric was for that, but if that's what's going on, then it makes sense, but it's still bad and wrong.
Yeah, and to some degree, I believe that the Volt was built to fit into like electric vehicle, like tax incentives and that sort of thing. They were looking to give tax incentives to electric cars that had a certain amount of range. And they're like, well, we have a gas motor that gives you more range. So it's, 400 miles of range, electric car, never mind that gas motor. But they were trying to compete with Tesla at this time, basically. Oh, so one thing about how they're sort of overbuilt is the battery is actively cooled and heated with its own coolant loop. And it's programmed to maintain a state of charge between 30 and 80%. To increase reliability. And GM actually covers the battery for, and certain other electrical drive components for 100,000 miles or 8 years. I believe in California, it might be 150,000 miles and maybe some other states.
A quick editor's note. Yes, it is 150,000 miles or 15 years, whichever comes first, in California and certain other states for plug-in hybrids that meet the TZEV category. That's transitional zero emissions vehicles. And those states include California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. So I'll put an article in the show notes that has some more information on how to identify one of these cars. It's not just any plug-in hybrid. It has to meet these emissions guidelines, and you have to buy it in and reside in one of these 11 states. All right, back to the show.
They also did a few updates over the years. In 2013, the battery capacity was upgraded to 6.5 kilowatts, and the electric range went up to 38 miles. So that is the first generation of the Volt. In 2013, they decided to make a Cadillac version. So this was called the Cadillac ELR, or Electric Luxury Roadster. It had an MSRP of $75,000, or $35,000 more than the Volt that it's based on. And I'm not sure what that compares to the Chevy Cruze, which it also shares the same chassis with. Despite being a two-door coupe, all that luxury means the ELR weighs 4,000 pounds. So it's like 200 pounds more than the sedan version. And this one is programmed to use all the both the electric motors and the combustion engine at once during sport mode. So it can, the 2016 model made 233 horsepower and 373 pound-feet of torque. So that means it has a power-to-weight ratio similar to a Ford Crown Victoria, and a 0 to 60 time of 6.4 seconds, which is pretty similar to a stock WRX or a 2007 Escalade, for context.
Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah.
If it makes you feel any better, the Escalade's got like three times the displacement to accomplish that.
Yeah.
And so I haven't been able to find too much information on this online. I came across this guy who is saying that he can reprogram the Volt ECU to make it think that it's a Cadillac ELR, and you can get up to 240 horsepower out of it. And then I think that brings the acceleration down to around 7 seconds for the Volt from 8.8. I haven't been able to find confirmation of this. It's just some guy on some message board saying this. I sent him some messages and he said, here, join my secret Facebook group. Here's the link for it. And so I, you know, clicked join group request. That was like over a week ago. I haven't heard anything back. So I'm not in the secret Facebook group yet. I'll update you if I ever hear back from this guy. But this is kind of what got me interested in the Volt, of like, maybe it would be cool to own one if I could have 240 horsepower in it.
Yeah.
And I was also kind of thinking, if you could find a Volt that's like a salvage title or been in a wreck on Copart or whatever for like a couple thousand dollars, you could turn it into a lemons car with this hack. And then, you know, if nothing breaks, which is a big if when you're, you know, putting almost 100 extra horsepower into it, then, you know, you'd have decent power and, you know, in theory, good mileage, which is good for endurance racing. So just an idea out there. So the second generation Volt went on sale for the 2016 model year. It had a whole bunch of upgrades. In fact, I don't think they share very many parts at all. They upgraded the battery so that the all-electric range is 53 miles, I think up from, 38? And the fuel economy in gasoline-only mode is 42 miles per gallon. It has a larger 1.5-liter combustion engine with an aluminum block that makes 101 horsepower, is able to run on regular 87-octane gas. The first generation, you needed premium for it, although I've heard people just running 87 and it's fine. And it's not like you're using a whole lot of gasoline anyways. They kept the total system power the same at 149 horsepower, but they increased the torque to 294 foot-pounds. And it uses a combination of two smaller motor generators to make this power. One is 117 horsepower and one is 64. And if you add that up, it's like 180 or something. So they are still underrating the power. It could make more. And it also has two planetary gear sets this time. So not only does it have the same one that acts as a two-speed transmission, but it has one that is more like a CBT, like the Prius. So it has more more latitude, more flexibility to run in different modes and get more efficiency in different conditions. So with all these upgrades, the second generation Volt is 250 pounds lighter than the first generation at around 3,500 pounds. So this gives it a similar power to weight ratio of a 2010 Prius and a 0 to 60 time of 7.4 seconds, the same as a 1972 Chevrolet Camaro Z28.
Killing me, bud.
And I've heard of some people getting as good as 7.1 second 0 to 60. I think maybe that depends on the year and the option and conditions and all that. That same guy that said he could get 240 horsepower out of a first gen Volt is saying he can get around 200 horsepower out of a second gen. Still haven't seen confirmation of if that's real, but I mean, I'm sure if you use both the electric motors and maybe the combustion engine at the same time and, you know, maybe put a little bit more juice than it's expecting, you could do that. So I think a couple years ago on the show, I talked about going to a local dealership and test driving a first gen Volt. And at the time, I didn't really like the interior and it felt a little bit heavy and underpowered. And I was like, yeah, this isn't for me. And, you know, after reading about these other things, I was like, oh, maybe I should take another look at this, you know? And so yesterday I went to another local dealership and test drove a 2017 second generation Volt. And it is a lot improved and it has really good torque off the line. Like it'll spin the wheels if you don't have traction control on. The first generation like felt like it had good pickup, but then it just kind of fell off. Like if you're accelerating on the highway, it would your acceleration at like 50 was a lot less than at 30. And I also like the interior better on the second generation. It's more like a normal car. It doesn't look like a spaceship. It's not trying to be weird and funky. I mean, it still has the LCD instead of a gauge cluster, but yeah. So I am kind of actively shopping for a second-gen Volt right now to replace my Subaru because in real-world conditions, it accelerates just as fast as my Subaru. And it is a little bit less practical. It's a little less roomy. The rear seat, I sat in the rear seat just to see. And like I barely fit in it, and I'm not a big guy. So and I almost hit my head on the door jamb getting in there. So like it's a little bit cramped. Also, I don't know why the first gen had like a little window underneath the main window, kind of like a Prius, where you have a little bit extra visibility in the rear. So, or like a Honda CRX. So you have your sloped rear glass window, and then you have a vertical pane that's sort of just a thin, not very tall rectangle that's long underneath that. That gives you a little bit better rear visibility. The second gen does not have that. I'm not sure why. And as a result, it has really bad rear visibility. I mean, at least it does have a backup camera, but it's kind of annoying. I don't. Maybe it's an aerodynamics thing. Maybe they didn't want to have that extra window in the hatchback or whatever. But yeah, so I'm on the market for a second gen Volt. I'd really like a blue with the brandy colored interior and the premium package, because I like the wheels on the premium package and because it comes with all the electric gizmos like radar cruise control and lane keep assist. And I think some years even have automatic parallel parking. So I don't know if I would use all those, but
I haven't driven a lot of newer cars actually, because I drive what I drive. Mm-hmm. Lane keep assist is one of the most infuriating features I have ever driven in a car with. Like I hate it so much.
It's horrible.
Okay, I've never used it before, so
annoying.
Maybe it I'll
wants, it would like it doesn't feel intuitive, dude. It kind of fights you when you're actually driving. It more or less wants you to not be driving.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that on the Volt, it's a pretty low-tech version of this, and basically it'll like bounce you between the lines like a bowling ball or something.
To be sure, I did not drive a high-end car that had that.
Yeah.
I just found it very frustrating, because when you start getting near the line, the steering wheel auto-corrects, and I'm like, no, I'm driving this car, leave me alone.
Yeah. My brother's girlfriend has a Volkswagen Tiguan that has the like automatic braking. It kind of saved us when we were driving in it, because we were backing out of a parking spot and someone came, you know, flying through the parking lot at like 40 miles an hour, almost ran into us, and you know, it put on the brakes and stopped us from backing out all the way.
I think features like automatic braking and lane keep assist are not intended for people who enjoy the driving experience, and it's like,
right,
it's very much a just get you where you're going sort of feature. But
yeah,
I had to drive like 100 miles in something that had that, and it was, I had to like figure out how to turn it off. It was just too much for me.
Yeah, you know, one thing I also liked about the second gen Volt is it has like a little, I mean, it has a regular Prindle shifter, like a, you know, just a regular shifter like is in a Malibu or whatever, that goes from park to reverse to low. I mean, not, there's other ones in between. You know, what is it? Park, reverse,
neutral. Are you just saying it's not like a
neutral
dial
drive
button?
Low?
Yeah, no, it's just a regular center console shifter. And if you put it in low, it engages the engine braking, or the regenerative braking with the electric motors. And basically that means it's like you let off in a regular gas car and you use engine braking. It's similar to that, except that power is going back into the battery. And it also has like a paddle on the steering wheel that you can press for more regenerative braking. And you can use that to like fully stop the car. And so you can do basically one pedal driving where you're only using the gas pedal and you don't have to touch the brakes hardly at all in, you know, stop and go traffic or whatever.
I feel like every now and then the draw of good fuel economy makes me want to buy something modern, and then I have a conversation like this and realize that that is not what I want. I don't want any of this.
Well, you can also put it in drive, and then it'll just coast. It doesn't engage the regenerative braking unless you hit that paddle or the brake pedal. But yeah, I mean, I like the way it drove. So like I said, I'm thinking about buying one. For a first generation, you can get them like, I've seen them as low as like $4,000 or $5,000 for ones that have a lot of miles on them. Second gen start around like $7,000 or $8,000 and go up to like $25,000 if you have like no miles on a, you know, 2019 with all the options. 2019 is when they stopped making them. Although I think they still make the Buick version in China. But yeah, I mean, most of them are around like 12 to 15 for a decent second generation. And that's kind of the range I'm looking at.
Another quick editor's note. A lot of listings that you find online include that $4,000 federal EV tax credit. So they'll say, you know, it's only $10,000, but actually it's $14,000. So, you know, look out for that in the fine print, and you might have to actually call the dealership to get the real price. Yeah, I don't know. Capitalism is sneaky like that, I guess. All right, back to the show.
I don't know if I can find that, the blue one with the premium package and the everything that I'm looking for that price, but I'll be looking. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's worth it to get one that's still under warranty for the battery. So under 100,000 miles in 8 years, because most of the ones that I found are at like, you know, 70 to 90,000 miles, even if they are, and they're, you know, what is 8 years ago? That's like 2016 or something. So
yeah.
Like, you know, the first year of second gens are already too old for the warranty. And if I got a 2017, it would be out of warranty next year. So, something to think about, I guess. But I don't know. That's what I'm weighing my options on.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What the fuck is a warranty?
You know, it's something I've never experienced myself. So it's all kind of new to me. But yeah, that's kind of the rabbit hole that I've been going down. Any other thoughts before we wrap this one up, or has this just been me monologuing about weird nerdy shit for a long time?
I mean, it's a little bit that, but even I've talked about, because I mean, if anyone that actually listens didn't know, I lost my job, so I don't have a job to ride my bike to anymore. And the next one I get, I probably can't ride my bike to. Even the closer ones that I've been applying to would effectively require me riding 3 miles, like, over a mountain because, you know, Pittsburgh. But, yeah, I gotta, like, at least seriously consider getting something more modern. And if I'm gonna go that route, it's probably just not gonna be a fun thing. It'll be a utilitarian thing, so.
Yeah.
You know, learning more about hybrids is definitely not something that bothers me.
Yeah, and I mean, I will say that, like, the second gen Volt is not a sports car. I mean, none of these are sports cars, but, like, it is a decently quick car, and it's, I think, probably more than most people need for their everyday drive as far as, like, power and acceleration. So, I don't know why this technology isn't used more often, but, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That's about all I got. I guess check out our social media. Send us an email if you have strong opinions about hybrid cars or anything else we talked about.
I mean, we didn't really go down this avenue, but I kind of am of the train of thought that hybrid is the way to go beyond gas or electric.
Yeah.
Like, there should be more emphasis on, you know, buses, trains, you know, public transportation, and less on, you know, getting the most fuel efficient car imaginable. But
yeah,
I mean, it's where do you want to do your imperialism at? Do you want to do it in the Middle East, or do you want to do it in countries where there are lithium deposits? that's the gas versus electric argument in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just so much more efficient in, like, 90% of conditions to have a plug-in hybrid than anything else, that for me, it's a no-brainer as far as, like, you know, energy usage and everything. So one thing I forgot to mention earlier is I had this idea that turned out someone else had this idea before me. I found a patent for someone that is using a planetary hybrid transmission for a bicycle. As far as I know, no one has actually done this for, like, an e-bike. But, like, you can get a bicycle with a CVT. They're not very efficient. And you can get an e-bike. But this type of CVT that would be more efficient seems like it would be a good fit for an e-bike, where you have, basically, you could pedal at a constant speed and a constant load, and speed up or slow down however you wanted with, like, a throttle or something. Like, you could have basically a hybrid bicycle rather, or I should say, it would be, you know, instead of the Honda Insight style hybrid, it would be more like a Prius style hybrid. And
I would argue that since biking is good for the glutes, that it would actually be an ass electric hybrid.
That's a good one.
Thank you. That was totally off the cuff, actually.
but yeah, I'm just putting that out there. Like I said, someone else beat me to the idea, but they haven't put it into practice. So, like, someone should make this. I think it would be cool. That's cool. The extent of my pitch there. Cool. All right. Should we wrap it up here, guys?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Well, goodbye.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
We gonna make you fight fire with fire, bitch. We make you fight fire with water, bitch. We gonna fight racism, not racism, but we gonna fight the solidarity. We said we're not gonna fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we gonna fight the socialism.
Amazingly, or not so amazingly, Cuba's crime rate is one of the lowest in the entire hemispheres. Oddly enough, it seems that when people have their basic human needs met, they're less likely to commit crimes.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
The free market mythology, it argues that the most ruthless, selfish, opportunistic, greedy, calculating plunderers, applying the most heartless measures in cold-blooded pursuit of corporate interest and wealth accumulation, will produce the best results for all of us. Through something called the invisible hand.
What are you smiling about?
Dude, I almost had you.